On today's show, Ben Elwood joins me for our final David Lynch episode. Yes, it's the end of our Deep Dive Director series as we look at Inland Empire. My name is Justin Hamilton, and this is also the finale of Season 5 of Big Squid. Yes, you have joined us for the finale of Season 5, which has ended up being 86 episodes. I really don't have any idea how long a season is going to go. Maybe the next one will be shorter. I have no idea. It kind of revolves around the Deep Dive Director series. So once we get to the end of that, that always feels like the finale of a season. So basically what we're going to do is you'll have this episode, and then there'll be a little break as I do work on preparation for Season 6, and then I'll be back in just a few weeks. And over the course of the rest of this year, I'm going to be balancing this podcast. I'm back at The Chase. I'm back at Question Everything. There's live performances, and there's some hush-hush Secret Squirrel projects that I'm working on. So the end of this year is going to be full on. So I need to have this little break, which technically is a break, but I'm working all the way through it. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get ahead of everything, so then when things get really busy, I've got a bit of breathing space to make sure that this podcast comes out on time for you. So hang around for the end of this podcast, and I'll tell you about some of the things we're going to be doing in our next season. A few little changes and some of your favorites, so it'll be a nice little blend there. So I'll tell you more about that at the end. Adelaide, it is also time to let you know the second wave of guests for our Big Squid live show on September 16 at the Rhino Room. And the new guests include Georgia Mooney, Limo, Mickey D, and making his Big Squid debut, I reckon this guy's going to go places, Will Anderson. That's right, I'm producing a show in Adelaide that has all of them, including Rove, Tom Gleason, Adam Richard, and Ben Elwood. And not only that, my listeners can score a discount on their tickets by using the promo code BIGSQUID. It is going to be a big night, and my guests are going to be discussing the art and entertainment that influenced them before they hit the big time. And one of my guests in particular is going to be talking about how the Paul Hogan Show influenced one of their most celebrated characters. So if you would like to come to the show, and since you're a loyal listener, remember to use the promo code BIGSQUID, and you can get the tickets at adelaidecomedy.com. Melbourne and Sydney, ticket sales for my solo show, Little Victories, have been, to be honest, have been fantastic. I can't thank you enough. I honestly had a moment of putting on a show in Melbourne thinking, is anyone going to remember me? It's been a long time since I performed in Melbourne, so turns out some of you do. And I appreciate that, so thank you. And I can't wait to perform this new show at the Sydney Comedy Store on the 28th of October and at Comedy Republic on the 26th of November. So once again, my Big Squid listeners can save some money on your ticket. Make sure you use the promo code PODCAST. So I want to reward your loyalty for listening to this podcast, so make sure you use the promo code PODCAST to get some money off all of your ticket purchases. So this is my first solo show since pre-COVID. So what a shame nothing's happened since then and there's nothing to talk about. People in Adelaide accidentally saw the show, and because I didn't know it was a show then. So when I performed at the Rhino Room in June and then I got off stage, I was like, oh, I have a show. That's interesting. So that is what I will be bringing to your cities. So if you would like to come along, please do so. And if you know anyone else who you think might be into my stand-up, that would be great as well. Patreon subscribers, don't forget you have a different discount that is even juicier than this podcast one. I'll post the codes for all three shows on the Patreon site with this week's script. So make sure you use that code. And when you sign up for Patreon, you not only have access to bigger discounts to live events, you also gain an opportunity to listen to extra podcasts. You know, between you and me, there is going to be a tasty little podcast coming out later this week that is going to have my thoughts on two trailers that dropped last week. Pretty big week for me. Two trailers. It was a teaser trailer for Oppenheimer and a new trailer for Moon Age Daydream. Yeah. So I'm going to save that for the Patreon. So keep an ear out for that later on. But anyway, when you sign up for the Patreon, you will gain access to podcasts like that, scripts, works in progress, all sorts of bonuses. And you also have an episode dedicated to you. And today's shout out goes to Glenn Merry and his family, Suze and Oscar. Glenn, thank you for your support, not just on this podcast, but throughout the years. Glenn and I have known each other and been friends for a long time. He started coming to see me perform live at The Shelf at the Melbourne Comedy Festival. We were trying to work out in our last email exchange if it was 2012 or 2013. Glenn, was it maybe when The Dollop first came out? Or maybe it was Walk the Room. Maybe it was even as far back as then. So thank you for not only supporting me at the Melbourne Comedy Festival with The Shelf and solo shows, but the old podcast, Can You Take This Photo, Please? That was my first podcast. Ah, such memories. And The Shelf podcast with Adam Richard. So many podcasts back in the day, all consolidated here now. It's a real treat to have such a long relationship with Glenn. So thanks, mate. And I appreciate you always checking in to see what I'm up to. I don't take it for granted to have someone's loyal listenership and always such delightful emails as well. So thanks, mate. And I hope you're avoiding that storm out west. Or depending on when you hear this podcast, you've avoided that storm. It looks a bit scary. So batten down the hatches and I hope everything's fine. If you'd like to join our growing Big Squid community on Patreon, head to patreon.com/JustinHamilton_BigSquid and you will find a tier that suits you. Make sure you hang around until the end for an update on season 6, but now it is time to meet Nikki, an actress who takes on a role in a new film. Her excitement is tempered by the fact her jealous husband has given a warning to her co-star about making any romantic overtures. This is difficult because their characters are having an affair, and to make matters worse, they discover the film they're making is a remake of an unfinished movie where the stars were murdered. Come and join me as we hold hands with David Lynch and visit Inland Empire.
From Hollywood, California, where stars make dreams and dreams make stars.
You have a new role to play, I hear.
Up for a role?
No, no. I definitely heard that you have it.
Action.
Damn! This sounds like dialogue from our script.
Cut it. What the bloody hell's going on?
Is this good? Oh, please.
Our producers know the history of this film, and they've taken it on themselves not to pass on that information to us. Purposefully.
Something's wrong. Do you love me? It's a story that happened yesterday. But I know it's tomorrow. Don't you remember anything? How it was?
If you're going to finish a run on a director, you should finish with the movie that is the pure heroine version of every film that they've made. So when we first talked about this, you hadn't seen the movie before, is that correct?
No, I'd never seen it before.
Ever, right.
No. In fact, I was scared of it. I feel like my relationship with this movie was similar to Naomi Watts' relationship with the videotape in The Ring.
Right,
like,
there was
a real fear.
Great.
Like when I read, what's that Grant Morrison comic, Nemesis?
Nameless.
Nameless.
Yes.
Like when I finished Nameless,
yes.
I don't do magic very often, but I did a banishing spell because I was convinced that something gnarly from a dark dimension had gotten into my head.
Right.
And that's similar to this film.
Yes.
Like I was scared to watch this film.
Yes. There is something Lovecraftian about this movie.
Yeah.
I had seen it once before. And I remember watching it by myself and then having a little lay down on the lounge for 2 or 3 hours. Just a bit like, what have I just experienced? And then, weirdly, the movie had not stuck in my memory.
Mm.
Bits of it had.
Yeah.
Like, bits of it kind of cling to your brain and pop up in such diverse ways. But the overall arch of the film was like, oh, this is actually feeling quite new when I watched it a second time. And then I've watched it a third time too. Because this is by far, of every film we have done for the deep dive directors, from Nolan to Sofia Coppola to Lynch, this is the hardest one to write.
Oh, yeah. Well, when you say that you couldn't remember the arc of it, I think that that's by design.
Yeah.
Like when we talk about Lynch's films being dreamlike, this is the most dreamlike.
Yeah.
Like when I spoke to you after the first time I watched it, I said, I'm going to have to watch it again to even be able to have a semi-coherent conversation about it. Because if you put me on the spot a day after I watched it and said, what happens in the movie? I'd be like, there's some rabbits.
Yeah.
Laura Dern freaks out.
Yeah.
Someone gets stabbed with a screwdriver. I'm not really sure what. Like, but you know, it's similar to a really vivid dream you have.
Yeah.
And the shape of it's in your head when you wake up. But as each minute goes by, you lose more and more chunks until all you're left with is resonant images.
Yeah.
And really nothing else.
And a vague vibe.
A vibe, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely a vibe.
Yeah. So funny. So, and normally, like, what I'll do is I'll watch the film. If it's one that I know really well, like Lost Highway, I just kind of took notes all the way through that one. If it's one that's new, I'll watch it, and then I'll watch it a second time, you know, one eye on the screen, one eye just writing notes as I go along.
Mm.
And this one, both times when I was trying to write notes, I'd give up after about 20 minutes because it's just fragments and and also there's so much going on, you're actually missing the movie.
Yeah. So you watched it twice for this?
Yes.
Yeah, right, yeah.
So what I've
essential.
Done, oh, man.
Yeah.
Like, thank goodness I really enjoyed it because otherwise I'd just say, why don't we just finish one short?
With all that said, I fucking love it.
Yes.
Like, I love this movie.
Yes.
It's immediately in the top five for me.
Yes,
of
great.
What he's done.
Well, we're going to do. Yes. We're going to do at the end for you our list of where we rank our Lynch films, which is also it's going to be funny because things that finish towards the bottom I really like.
Yeah.
So we've had a good run with directors. There hasn't been a movie yet where you just go, well, that's quite clearly bottom.
Yeah.
Like everything's really, and after three versions of my list, I have walked away from it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, essentially it's quite arbitrary and, you know, could shift at any time.
Yeah,
so.
It's how I feel at the moment.
Yes.
So the way I thought we could interpret this is that I thought I would share, if you want to share your interpretation and I can also share my interpretation.
Yeah.
And then what we can do is we can bounce off that while we go through the script.
You tell me yours because I only kind of came to what I think about it on the way here.
Okay. Oh, and what I also have for you, which is really funny, was I wrote all of this down and then a few days later, went on to inlandempirefandom.fandom.com, the wiki page there, because I try to avoid that, except for when I'm doing, you know, the squid bits part. And then I saw the plot synopsis there and I'm like, well, that's why the words interpretation.
See, I'm going to confess, a lot of what I think is from that.
Yeah.
Based on stuff that I was thinking when I watched it last night, but I actually love that interpretation. We'll get to that.
Oh, yeah,
we'll
so do I. Yeah, so yeah, do yeah. I. Yep, so, yep. But this is kind of what I had going through me. I feel like my interpretation is a little bit more oblique and more an emotional reading of it than this is what happens.
Yeah.
So what I wrote is, Inland Empire is also described as a movie about a woman in trouble. We then see many women in this movie who are in different states of peril. I think this is a movie about how society is ruined by the patriarchy, particularly towards women, but even some types of men. Everyone is viewed through the lens of the patriarchy and act accordingly, and are also trapped in those views.
Mm-hmm.
Laura Dern plays Nikki, an actress who in classic Lynch style goes to Hollywood full of dreams and promises. She is treated poorly and her pain is turned into entertainment. In the process of becoming part of the Hollywood machine, she loses sight of herself, which a lot of other women also have happened to them. Meanwhile, a sad woman watches the product of Nikki's pain that has been transformed into entertainment. But somehow the truth of Nikki manages to cut through to the woman who is inspired to turn away from the sadness of her life and Hollywood. And in that respect, she returns to the world that makes her happy. She does return to a conventional life of man, woman, and child, but there is hope that they can approach this version of life with a sense of enlightenment. In the process, this frees Nikki from her misery too, and she can vanquish the phantom who is representative of the patriarchy. Her art and truth have managed to rise above the way she's been manipulated and the way society views her and other women. In the end, the women dancing and singing Cinnamon is cathartic. Usually a song about a sinner trying to escape divine justice on Judgment Day. The woman who sings directly to the camera. She sings to us.
Mm.
Were the sinners along with Hollywood and were the people that justice is coming for. And that, and my last line was, at least that's what I think it means today.
That's great. That actually is fantastic. And I think that there's a lot of, yeah.
So even, you know, you've read that synopsis, which we'll read for the listeners, but it doesn't necessarily discount it, but that's kind of the emotional reading I got.
Well, I think that the more kind of beat for beat, quote unquote, literal, because what's literal in this world, interpretation that I've kind of glommed onto doesn't exclude what you've just said.
Yeah.
I think what's so incredible about this, it's, you know, it's 3 hours, it's sprawling, it's got multiple dimensions, it's got multiple timelines.
Yeah.
There's, as there is in every Lynch movie, replicants of replicants, on and on and on.
Yeah.
So, more than any of his other movies, more than Mulholland Drive even, I think you can have 10 concurrent interpretations that are all true at the same time.
Yeah.
Like there's so much going on in this. Like it's the first one where I felt truly overwhelmed, and like so many quote unquote normal people do when they watch just an average Lynch movie.
Right.
You know how like people who aren't into his stuff watch whatever, Wild at Heart, and go, whoa, that was fucking crazy. I don't know what to make of that.
Yeah.
It's like, no, it's pretty straightforward. It's just like a fucked up love story. That's how I felt with this one.
Yeah.
Really out of my depth.
Yeah. It felt
really out of my depth.
Yeah. Well, I'll be honest with you. I felt like at the end of it, I had, you know, like a mild panic erection. It was like, Jesus Christ, how am I going to put this into any coherent form that's just not us talking around in circles? Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. like trying to find a driving force. So it was like, I had to sit on it for a few days, and then I had to rewatch it, and then really focus on some sort of through line for our sakes, and then anyway.
So, in your interpretation of it, with the girl in the hotel, crying and watching Nikki slash Sue's art,
and seeing, you know, and we'll talk more about this later, but like the rabbit stuff to me is the sausage making machine of Hollywood just releasing shit that, you know, just, you know, they're all sort of saying it's reinforcing stereotypes, and there's a laugh track to things that are non sequiturs.
So in your interpretation, do you not think that the rabbits are influencing events at all? Or that's just kind of one more layer going on in the indictment of Hollywood?
I'm guessing that they're influencing her in the sense that she's really sad. You know?
Yeah.
She's sitting there going, you know, it's like in a more conventional TV show, that's the seventh season of Two Men and a
Two and a half men,
you know?
I think that the rabbits are influencing stuff because there's that moment where the Polish men are having some kind of seance or some kind of ritual where they're summoning the girl in the hotel room, and then they transform into the rabbits.
Yes.
And also, we're gonna sound like we've got dementia talking about this movie.
No, it's great.
And then
people already think that listening to this podcast that this will be nothing new. This will just reinforce their.
Yeah, but this is like a whole new level. Yeah. This is the first movie that I've been actually afraid to talk about, but really like I don't know how to talk about this in any kind of coherent, intelligent way. Yeah.
But yeah, the Polish men doing the seance
turn into the rabbits.
Yeah,
and then at the end. It's almost like the rabbits are, for me anyway, the rabbits are assisting Nikki from breaking out of this kind of curse that she's in.
Right.
Of having to live this multidimensional life.
Yeah, so kind of like not dissimilar, like we're coming at it from different angles, but it's the holding her in place kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's a really easy movie to just... and now we're talking about the last half hour. And now we're going to go back to the first 17 minutes. And now we're in the middle hour.
Yeah.
In many ways, this feels like an emotional sequel to Mulholland Drive, where we once again follow an actress, Laura Dern as Nikki Grace, as she lands a part in a film called On High in Blue Tomorrow.
That's such a David Lynch phrase. On High in Blue Tomorrow.
It's so funny. As the actor merges with her character, the film and reality lose their relationship to time and space. What do these two movies have to say about actors and the craft of acting?
It's interesting. I think that there was I think that there's... It really shows the trauma that comes from being a performer.
Yeah.
You know, because I think another interpretation of this is that she gets so lost in the role that she can't discern anything between her own reality and the reality of her character.
Yeah.
And there is that moment where she fully inhabits the life of Sue.
Yeah.
You know, and you think about that with some of these performances that actors and actresses put in where it's like, how do you just switch on that level of emotion and go, brrr, cut. Okay, and just go back to your life.
Well, how many times are there affairs on sets? Yeah, like, it makes sense because you subsume who you are and then you are spending a lot of time often acting like, you know, like I love to make fun of acting and call it, you know, pretensies. You know, just professional pretensies.
Yeah.
And it is. So
professional dress-ups.
Yeah, you know, and... Like, I like to be a bit dismissive of it while also thinking it's a real craft and also loving it. I think it's more the focus on it rather than the actual craft itself. But it's also, like, there's just so many actors that I've met who, you know what, that's not fair. So many performers across the board who, when you talk to them off stage or from when they're not on a camera, it's like, what am I getting here?
This is
just not a real human being. And they chip away at themselves to such an extent to play all these different people. And I think that's why they end up in these weird places and weird relationships. And
Peter Sellers would talk about that.
Yeah.
That there was no real Peter Sellers.
Right.
Like, he would openly speak about that. There was no actual... He was just this balsa wood kind of shell.
Yeah.
And the reason that he had to play these characters was because it was the only way he could feel human and alive.
Right.
And it's, you know, in that kind of extreme, it's a form of psychopathy, I think. But, you know...
that explains his appearance in the Get Back doco as well, where everyone's really relaxed and he's like, oh, I don't know how to act in this moment.
Absolutely.
Which character do I portray?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I know he's been cancelled, but the Jeffrey Rush, I can't remember what the name of the movie is, but where he plays Peter Sellers, it's actually very interesting.
Yeah.
Kind of morphing in between these different roles to feel, you know, like a man.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just don't know, like, I think the older I get, the more I appreciate acting. I think when I was younger, I used to look at acting and go, yeah, I could do that.
Yeah.
And then you look at some performances and it's, you know, like a love performance.
Yeah.
Where two people are like deeply in love or they're fucking on screen or whatever they're doing, staring into each other's eyes. I mean, it's been scientifically proven that if you sit across from a stranger and stare deeply into each other's eyes for 15 minutes and ask each other a few key questions, something starts going off in the brain where, You might not fall in love with the person, but it is the illusion of feeling in love.
Yeah.
I went to the Marina Abramović exhibition a few years ago. Do you know her?
No.
She's this, I can't remember what, Eastern European country. She's a very famous performance artist, and her big thing is sitting across from other people and staring into their eyes. And it was this warehouse in Circular Quay, and you would go in, you had to surrender your phone, your watch, everything, and you had to exist in a completely silent space. And there were all these activities like sorting white beans from black beans, and it was all about getting in a meditative, calm, timeless state. And then they had chairs opposite each other where you would sit and a stranger would sit opposite you and you would stare into their eyes. And I had a session with a stranger. I don't know how long it went for, but it felt like it went for a good hour, where it was one of the most intense relationships I've ever had with anyone ever in my life.
Right.
It was crazy just staring into this person's eyes. And we were laughing and crying, and it was like this full-blown relationship in miniature. And then she just stood up and that was it. It was gone. And then you think about these actors that are like, you know, for months and months playing a married couple or a couple intensely in love. I don't know how you... Do they just switch it on and off? How do you not take some of that home with you? How does it not have some kind of impact on you outside of the realm of making a film?
Well, I guess the most mature and fully formed of actors probably, you know, they end up having these really close relationships, don't they? Like, it's just a close friendship, you know? So, but if you're, you know, if you're not on top of it, it can morph into something else. Especially also, it's not just the physical act of being, you know, in a close proximity with someone that you're performing with. It's also the fact that you also have to have a level of trust that the director who is filming you is not making the worst movie or TV show that you've ever seen.
Sometimes I feel
bad for actors who are putting in a pretty good performance in something that ends up being mush. But then on top of it, you get the... pardon me. You get the... sorry, I'm getting all emotional. I'm thinking about all those actors that have had a tough time. But then you have to think about, you know, the paparazzi and social media and all of that pressure when, oh, what's going on with them, you know, and all of that's starting to come in as well, you know. It's, you know, so I found... a thing where Lynch said that he thinks acting is a threat to the stability of the self.
Which
makes a lot of sense.
That's like a big theme of what I think is happening in this, you know. I mean, beyond just the acting of being in a relationship or something, like, how does someone play, you know, a psychotic serial killing pedophile, say, for 6 months?
And then
walk away from that not fucking damaged somehow?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Especially when you hear about like all the research. Like, I know I don't think it's actually true, but there was that big urban legend going around about Heath Ledger, you know. Oh, he died because he got too immersed in the Joker role.
When he was well past doing
But, you know, I think that that story is probably true in metaphor, not even necessarily about Heath, but just like, you see some roles where it's so fucked up what they're doing on screen. Not even physically, but just the place they have to go.
Yeah, they get a little bit trapped with the character. They find that it takes a while to shake it off.
But I mean, we've seen that just in stand-up comedy. You know, you get boxed into the type that people think that you are, and all of a sudden you're behaving in ways in your offstage life that aren't even really you.
Yeah,
but they're, you know, like, oh, I'm the fucking angry guy, so I better get angry, and that'll be funny. I just, you know, I mean, maybe that's part of the training, how to leave the whole thing behind.
Yeah,
but I can't, you know, at the end of the day, these people are still human, and I don't think that it would be that easy to shake off when you're fully immersed in something.
Yeah.
You remember, do you remember that sex scene in Monsters Ball?
Yeah.
With Halle Berry and Billy Bob?
Yeah.
I saw that movie, 15 years ago? And I think about that once a week. Like, right. What the fuck? That is so intense. It's so intense.
Yeah.
You know, and then to think that you're doing it on a live set surrounded by a crew and you're going to that place. Like... either you take it home with you, or you're a psychopath that has a switch in the back of your head that can just turn it off.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what's going on in this film. I think she's completely subsumed by the role, and yes, she can't delineate between herself and the performance anymore.
You know, it's actors, it's as I said, it's all performers. I know, look, I'm not going to mention any names on this story, but I know someone who was on a reality performance show and thought that the person that they were working with was interested in them, and it turned out they were not. And the person that I knew very matter-of-factly talked about they were so upset and so angry that when they had to do this thing that was really intimate, right, in distance, before she did it, she ate a whole onion. Anyway. And that's not even, like, that's...
Yeah, that's fucking reality
that's,
TV.
That's not Billy Bob and Halle Berry having, yeah, to have their safe word.
Yeah, yeah,
you,
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Crazy, right? Do they actually have, I mean, is that true? They have to have a safe word?
No, well, I don't know, but do you know, okay, what I mean? I'm just saying this is someone just doing a poxy reality TV thing that lasted only a short amount of time,
yeah,
and they're already going, I'm going to get back at this person who's rejected me because they're not into... Totally. Me, so I'm going to go the full Tony Abbott and eat an onion. It's like, it's insane.
It's insane.
I feel like my favorite actors are the ones who are less successful and mostly live amongst real people. And I feel that way about any entertainment professional. It's like, gone are the days where, like, Al Pacino was a massive star and he was like, I'm going to go and do theater. And then, and then he disappears. Yeah, and then he's like, oh, I'll come back and do movies now. And, you know, even if you try, if you're a big star and even if you try to go off and do other things, there's people jumping out and taking photos. Well,
especially
and,
now.
You're on social media, yeah.
Especially now. I mean, did you see that footage of Tom Hanks wigging out at some photographer?
No.
I thought it was so cathartic. And, of course, it's the internet, so everyone had their own fucking take. Some people are like, he's a psycho. But he was being just followed down the street, him and his wife.
Right.
And it was that real American oppressive, like,
right,
fuck, man. This, yeah, is crazy.
Yeah.
I think I saw an interview with him where he said how nice it was being in Australia.
Yeah.
You know, people would just walk by and go, hey, Tom, and keep,
yeah,
walking.
Yeah.
No one really gives a shit.
Yeah. I think I've told you that when Tarantino was in Melbourne for Inglourious Basterds, I just happened to be a few, like, maybe 100 metres behind, yeah, him, you know, when you're walking along and then suddenly someone yelled out, Quentin, and he just waved. And then someone else was like, hey, Quentin. He's like, hey, man, you, yeah, know. And to be honest, it was, and we just happened to be going in the same direction. So I got to watch that for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And it is something that I always keep in mind, even when he does things that I find to be a bit gauche or, you know, a bit full on. I still remember him being very, like, nice to people who were stopping. Yeah, and, hey, yeah, yeah.
But it would be easier to be nice in that context and, yeah, not in that oppressive American context where it's like, you know, they're following you around, trying to goad you into a reaction so they can sell it to TMZ. And,
yeah,
just that, you know, again, it's just America. It's fucking insane.
Yeah.
So in the footage, Tom Hanks is walking along with his wife and he's just kind of like eyes ahead trying to get to his car.
Yeah.
And one of them kind of trips and falls into his wife. It's an accident, but, yeah, she freaks out.
Yeah.
As you would. It's, yeah, again, it's fucking America. You know, who, yeah, knows if they're not lunging at you with something. And Hanks just whips around and just goes, back the fuck off.
Yeah.
And like loses it.
Yeah.
You know, but it's... Sorry, I can't even remember why we.
No, that's been a no, but you know, it's the lens on the people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right. You can't. Yeah, exactly. And once you hit that level of celebrity, you can't function outside of,
yeah,
this idea that people have of you.
It's the Tobey Maguire footage. I'm not sure that I'm the biggest Tobey Maguire fan, but he's in his car and there's so many cameras going off. He's literally saying to them, "I can't see, and I'm trying to turn onto the road, and this is fucking dangerous." And it's, yeah, but you know, then like we've talked about this before. Not everyone is equipped to deal with any level of light stardom, whether it is the biggest actor in the world, the biggest musician in the world, or someone who's the most popular person in their small town.
Yeah,
like,
that's right.
Some people just can't deal with... They can deal to a certain level, but if it goes that next step, that's when they become delusional.
Mm, yeah.
In the final scene of this, we see Laura Harring, who played Rita in Mulholland, yes, Drive, and she shares a look with Nikki. I kind of interpreted that as she was the previous woman, defined by the way other people viewed her, and now they're both free and she can sit with a man in friendship at the end in comfort. And then
Great.
I think the monkey is a tacit reminder of where we came from. That's what the monkey is. Like, we're all just monkeys. And then, I saw something about this later. And there's in that final scene, there's the guy sawing
the lumberjack. Wood.
Yeah. I reckon he's just doing his job, ignoring the distractions around him. I feel like that's how Lynch, my interpretation is that's how Lynch views what a man should be. Just get on with the job, mate.
Yeah. And occasionally, soaring to the beat.
Yeah, soaring to the beat, yeah. But you don't, there might be all these hot women around. But you know what? Don't ogle them. Just get on with your job, mate.
Yeah. Great.
And we're all monkeys.
That final sequence is is un-fucking hinged.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Like, what a way to end that movie with a big, celebratory dance number.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. It's very cathartic. Yeah. Like, that's what I said earlier.
Yeah.
This also feels like it sets the table for Twin Peaks: The Return.
Yes.
In this movie, we get the story about the little girl who lived down the lane, which returns via Audrey Horn and the... Is it the disembodied shoulder? That's what it is, isn't it?
Oh, the arm.
The arm.
Yeah. The arm that turns into a tree with a blob of Play-Doh on top.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
And then...
You know what? So much of Twin Peaks Season 3 does make sense now that we've watched 10 Lynch movies in a row.
Oh, yeah. I am thinking about doing just for my own...
I've already started.
Yeah, right.
I'm back in.
Oh, Mr. Oh, we don't want to do Twin Peaks The Return. As if I could do that.
I'm halfway through Season 2. I'm going like the full thing, not just Season 3. Yep.
How funny. Great. You're very funny.
So great.
That's up there with, what do you mean you're going to leave me out of the Black Panther podcast? Still, fuck it. That's been making me laugh a lot. A lot. The other thing is we have Grace Zabriskie, who was, of course, Laura Palmer's mum, tells us the story to Nikki about the brutal fucking murder. Forgetfulness and magic, which feels kind of right coming from Laura's mum, doesn't it?
Fuck yeah.
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 We should also discuss the picture quality for anyone who is thinking I might give this a go. Lynch used a video recorder to make this film, and it must be one of the ugliest and most confronting films for that very decision.
Yes.
But I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you were the same as me. After a while, you're totally immersed in the world. And even though things like the close-ups, which are particularly confronting, but it's weird, isn't it? You just kind of...
I think I love it.
Yeah.
Like, I actually think, the first time I watched it, about 20 minutes in, I was like, trying to do that thing, imagining in my mind's eye what this would look like shot on celluloid, and would it be beautiful and everything. But I know so much of this movie was just ad-libbed and improvised on the spot. I mean, so that's why it's such a miracle that it comes together. But the form of it 100% suits the story being told.
Yes.
Like, I don't know. Like, I know that he's remastered it, and I've seen clips of it. Yeah, I've got
some stuff for that.
Yeah, like, there's clips of it that... And, it still looks janky, but it's a lot clearer. I don't know. I kind of... I like it.
Yeah.
I really like it.
Well, it's bizarre. Getting back to that dreamlike quality, it makes it... Because I often feel... When you're in a dream, it's pretty clear, and it's when you're coming out of the dream that it gets that, like you're coming up through water.
Yeah. Visual noise everywhere.
Yeah. The opening scene with the camera projecting into the dark heralds the beginning of the movie and illuminates the shadows. The gramophone tells us about the longest-running radio play in history, Axon N, which suggests a story as old as time itself. We see the blurred faces of an unpleasant encounter, and eventually that woman's face, known as the Lost Girl, comes into focus. Then the Lost Girl watches the show about the anthropomorphic rabbits who speak in non sequiturs. Explain.
Well, I think this might be a good time to kind of go over the interpretation of what is actually going on in this movie.
Yeah.
Which kind of is more of a beat-for-beat interpretation of it. But I like it. So, should we do that?
So, do you want me to go... But everyone doesn't know the synopsis one. So, do you want me to read that out now?
Well...
Because then we'll be...
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, because they're two... They're two different things. Yeah, so if we're not going to work off mine, we'll have to work off...
No, we can work off yours as well.
No, I know, but the audience doesn't know this bit.
Oh, all right. Okay, no. Continue and we'll do the other one as it comes up.
Okay, I was going to leave that plot synopsis at the end as a contrast.
Great, yep, perfect.
So the way I was looking at that is this is helping us descend into the unpleasantness of everyday society. I think we've talked about this, but I think the rabbits represent the banality of entertainment once you strip them of the razzle-dazzle of jokes and entertainment. Mm. At their core, it is the same shit over and over. Also, the longest-running radio show, I took it to be representative of everything in the world just repeating itself over time. Like, yep. Women keep getting treated like shit.
Yep.
We keep putting people in boxes. We yep. keep ignoring people
spewing
who need
help.
Spewing
out the help. Same entertainment over yeah. and over. Yeah,
but just people in general.
Yep.
Like, regardless of the entertainment.
Yep.
That's why it's the longest running radio play of all time. But it's funny just to even read out. And this is what happens at the start.
Yeah. the opening credits is terrifying. There's some kind of sound design that goes yeah. on when the title comes. Like,
yeah.
It's really... From the first second that this began, you are put in a state of real unsettled terror.
Yeah.
Again, it's not dissimilar to a lot of places we've been in other movies, but this is the most sustained.
Yeah.
This is like the scene of Bob crawling towards the camera, but for 3 hours.
For 3 hours. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned Nameless because the audio, this is weird because I'm relating it to a comic, but that droning sound in particular kind of reminded me of The Outer Church and The Invisibles and yeah. that sense of everything just kind of grinding yeah. against each other.
Yeah, wet gears.
Yeah. Ugh. One of the parts of this movie that I find the most interesting is that it isn't just about men treating women poorly, but also about how women can be bad in their own way to each other as well. The Polish woman who pretends to the neighbor who appears to send Nikki on her way into some sort of spiral is,
yeah,
you know, there's yeah, yeah, something yeah. very aggressive about her.
Well, there's like a Baba Yaga kind of
yes,
vibe to her.
Yes.
You know, Eastern European witch. Who yeah. seems to be laying down some kind of curse.
Yes.
Because she says, you know, the legend or the folk tale that I want to tell you, it's about the girl who goes to the market
yeah.
and gets lost behind the alley.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happens.
Is she the woman growing up? Is she the little girl growing up? Passing on the curse?
Yeah, that's what I think is going on.
Yeah.
I think that the curse is something that runs through this, you know, and that's when we go back in time to the early 20th century where we go yeah. to Poland with the horses and the carriages and stuff.
Yeah.
I think this is a curse that's, again, you know, going to that theme of repetition and the longer story, the longest radio play. This is something that keeps going on and on. But it's a very specific phrase, you know, the girl that goes behind the marketplace... And I can't remember, into the alley.
Yeah.
And that is what happens just before Laura Dern's character yeah. crosses over into the life of Sue.
Yeah. Yeah. And suddenly, you know, now the curse is attached to her and she's lost
yeah.
as well.
Yeah.
It's also interesting the way none of the women help Nikki after she's been stabbed by another woman at the end. Like everyone yeah. just kind of...
Freaks out
and watches. Also...
Do you think those women are... Her,
all of them.
Yeah, I think that they're. I think that they're splintered parts of her consciousness.
Oh, okay.
It's like the internal Greek chorus, the caucus inside your own head.
Right. I did think about the Greek chorus side yeah. of it, but I hadn't thought. Oh, yeah, I could. I can see that. Yeah. So then, the woman who stabs her is also her as well.
Yeah, or
like
the
id or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. I think the woman that stabs her is a separate entity from the other, because there's that group of prostitutes
yep.
that are hanging out at her apartment that dance the locomotion.
Yeah.
I think that's all her.
Right.
And then I think the woman that stabs her is the reincarnation of part of the curse.
Right, right.
That goes
part of
back,
the phantom.
Part of the phantom.
Yeah.
The scorned wife.
Yeah.
That continually is reincarnated throughout different iterations
yeah.
starting in early 20th century Poland.
Right.
This sounds so insane.
No. But it's, well, it is. But it's also, it's weirdly, there is a coherence to it.
There is a coherence.
Yeah.
Because there's motifs that keep yeah. popping up. And that's what you got to hold on. That's what I really held on to the second time. Screwdriver.
Yeah.
Green jacket.
Yeah.
The phantom.
Yeah.
You know, these are things that keep popping up.
Maybe the street workers, I don't know what the correct term these days is, but maybe they are also, maybe they're not just parts of a psyche, maybe they're previous characters she's performed, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So she, because she seems to be a successful actor who's, you know, at a certain point in her career. Also, the two homeless women who talk about themselves as Nikki dies.
Fucking crazy. Don't worry, baby. You're just dying.
Yeah, and then so then suddenly it's like she's dying there and it's like, oh, yeah, I wanted to catch this bus. And yeah, very funny. I think it's also just, you know, we once again, this is something we have talked about in previous podcasts, but, you know, from running rooms, I was always, some of the nastiest comments I've ever heard have been women about female comedians.
Oh,
and once again, just to reiterate why I believe that happens, it's the lack of representation. So there's less, you know, especially in the past, there's less female comedians. So therefore, it's more important that they represent each person, whereas you and I see a shit male comedian, we're fine. There'll be another 30 to fucking stand up and we're not going to take it personally.
Yeah, right. Yeah, sure.
You know, so like, you know, maybe if we were performing in Budapest and there were two Australian comedians on and one, you know, we were on probably. Second and the Australian comedian got on and was shit, we'd be like, ah, oh, what are you doing?
Yeah, no, probably. Absolutely.
So I think it kind of breaks down to that.
Yeah, right.
And then it's also... Pardon me. Yeah, there's the systematic reinforcement of the ways men view women that seeps into their own language and approach as well. I think that's something that is easy to be, you know, like I've heard women who would think of themselves as feminists and would say that very much so and very much are, call other women sluts. And you go, what?
Yeah.
So, and I think that's, I think that comes from language being all around you and infecting
also,
you.
Also, it just comes from being fucking human, right? Like, you know, no one is, we all have these labels that we, you know, like to live by and modes of thinking and stuff. But at the end of the day, we still have a kind of meat computer that's much more primal than it is modern. And so it is easy to default into modes of thought that, you know, consciously you don't necessarily abide by or agree with.
Yes. But I would also say I'm not racist and I don't go around being racist to people.
That's true.
But I understand what you're saying. Yeah. But I guess it's when, yes, like I ostensibly agree with you, but I just also just find it hilarious. I'm a feminist. I've read all this literature. I've done all of this. I've done all of that. I hate the way women are treated, blah, blah, blah. What do you think of Sally? She's a slut. What? How did that happen? Quite like Sally, whoever Sally is. When Nikki gets the role and has her first rehearsals, we see both the ways the patriarchy views the typical cliche with the role. She's told not to sleep with her leading man, and he's told not to sleep with Nikki. One is a warning, another is a good old boy nudge-nudge warning. Justin Theroux in these last two movies, I feel like he is the hyper-masculine realization of the type of man that Kyle MacLachlan used to represent in his earlier films. I'd like to see him. His approach to all his leading men has been fascinating, and I'd love to see what he would do with Theroux now, who's kind of at a slightly different stage, or he's definitely in a different stage of his career.
Yeah.
Because I just like I find it really interesting the way he uses him.
Or what he'd do with a younger actor that's kind of coming up now, that's of a different generation of acting. You know, like like a Pattinson, or even a Harry Styles. Like what would he?
Yep, Chalamet. You know, all of those young fellas. Patterson would be fucking interesting.
Awesome.
Oh man,
can we just comment that Justin Theroux's manager is Cameron Daddo?
Oh yeah, well I was going to mention that. Yeah, I was really excited when Cameron Daddo turned up. This is getting ahead of it, but so years ago when I towards the end of my time in Melbourne, I was just bummed out and I was just not doing anything, and I would sit at home, and I used to have I think it was Music Max on TV, and I used to watch that's when I was really getting into yacht rock. And Cameron Daddo used to host the show, and I would sit there, and there were two camera angles, and there was one where he's looking directly down the camera, and then the camera angle would change and it would be shooting him from the side. So, and it just used to make me laugh, and I'd sit there and he'd be like, "Hello, Welcome to the weekend. It's going to be a good time. We're going to be playing a lot of songs that you really love. So why don't you put your feet up, get yourself a glass of wine, and then the camera angle would change and he'd just keep talking in that same mellifluous tone. And then every time the camera angle would change, I would be on the lounge going, Cameron, I'm here, mate. Cameron. And then he'd turn back and then I'd be quiet. And it was something that made me laugh all the time. And then for ages, I wanted to do a show called Hammo Has Daddo Issues. Anyway, I was going to finish with Cameron Daddo as a voiceover telling me how to transcend life.
It's the one time that Cameron Daddo's, shall we say, limited range actually served him well.
Oh, he's really
the
good.
He's the perfect Lynch actor.
Oh, like, I wish there was more Daddo. This is what the film lacks. I would love to have seen more Daddo. I was rapt when he turned up. I was like, well, this is a treat I wasn't expecting. There's another treat in the film as well, but I'll wait till we get to the squid bits. Early in rehearsals, we discover that the film is a remake of a movie that was never made and both leads were murdered. This now leads to the idea that the film is cursed, and soon after this revelation, Nikki becomes lost in the role. She has trouble discerning what is real and what is the film. She eventually becomes unstuck in time and discovers she's the noise they hear at the studio earlier in rehearsals. Mm. Nikki escapes into the home of a character called Smithy. man, I don't know about you. I love moments like this in a film. I love it. Mm. Like, this is... Mm. This is McConaughey being the ghost. You know, this is all... I love stuff where it all comes in. You're like, oh!
Yep. It's also... There's a little bit of, like, dark parallel reality Wizard of Oz stuff going on.
Oh, you know? Which is through everything.
Through everything. But, you know, instead of exiting the house into Oz, she enters the house into this different life.
Yeah.
You know, and everything's different.
A Taste of Lost Highway. Yeah. All of that stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It is... this movie is a distillation of all his interests,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Into this nightmarish film.
It's funny you say that. Do you think that this is a movie that someone who wasn't kind of steeped in Lynch lore and a fan could enjoy?
I think you'd have to be open. Do you know what I mean? Like, you'd have to be up for the experience. And
imagine this was the first Lynch you ever saw.
Oh, I've heard about this David Lynch. I've heard that he does these great movies. I'll just check out Inland Empire.
Oh my god.
Excuse me, I'm just going to throw myself off the balcony. Then I'll come back and I'll discuss what I think happened. Nikki finds her husband and hides from him in a closet. Piotrek is an aggressive man who is suspicious of Nikki. Luckily, Nikki encounters a troop of street workers who tell her to burn a cigarette hole through silk and then to look through that hole. That's a magic thing, isn't it?
It's actually the lost girl that tells her to do that.
The lost girl, yes. Sorry, it is.
The lost girl talks through kind of some kind of shimmer in reality.
Yes.
And tells her how to see what's really going on.
Yes.
Which, you know, sure.
Yeah. Like, as I said, writing notes for this is a fucking was hard work.
Yeah.
It was like what's that meme with the wall with the strings and the arrows pointing at the guy looking insane? That was me trying to put this together. Nikki sees one of the film's characters, Doris Side, great name, tell a policeman that she's been hypnotized by someone called the Phantom to murder someone with a screwdriver, but she finds it stuck in her side.
Yes.
And I think this kind of gets back to what we were talking about earlier and is representative of women being shaped by a male-run society to do their worst to other women. But in turn, she ends up hurting herself.
Yes.
Anyway, once again.
No, it's great.
I feel like that's...
Yeah.
So the streetwalkers come across as a cross between the fates and the representatives of the types of women who have been left to look out for themselves. Mm-hmm. But also parts of her personality. Like, I like that interpretation too.
Well, she's always very silent around them.
Yes.
They're always doing the talking for her.
Yeah.
And she's kind of observing, like she's, you know, listening to her own thoughts.
Yeah. They're also connected by the story in the 1930s in Lodz, Poland, where street workers are beaten by pimps and murder hangs in the air. And this is the curse the neighbor utters at the start of the movie, that the oldest profession known to society has always been haunted by aggressive behavior from men.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, we'd all like to take a cigarette. Nikki joins the street workers but becomes Sue, where she confesses to a sweaty, untrustworthy policeman at a nightclub that she was abused in her childhood. She also talks about her husband, Smithy, who has connections to the underworld, a weak, useless man who can't kick out the people she doesn't want at her party. And I think the useless way he looks at her with the sauce all over his shirt and wondering where the napkins are, even though they're right in front of him, represents the crime of weak men who can't stand up for women. That was my deep dive interpretation of that. Mate, you got blood on your hands, mate. Get a napkin.
Smithy is the wife, the husband of Sue, the film character.
Yes.
And Piotrick is the husband of... What's Laura Dern's non... What's the alternate Laura Dern?
Hang on. So Sue.
No, Sue's the character within the movie.
And is he...
And Smithy is...
Isn't Piotrick also the husband of Sue? And Smithy is the husband of the lost girl?
No. Smithy's the husband of Sue.
Yeah.
And Piotrick is the husband of, what's her name? The actress that Laura Dern's playing.
Oh, yeah, right. Nikki. Sorry, Nikki.
So Piotrick
is
Nikki's husband and Smithy is Sue's husband.
Yes.
Yeah, and then later on... Smithy / I don't know if that even is Smithy at the end that reunites the lost girl.
Right.
I think because this is the guy that's been kind of part of the curse that's been reincarnated over and over and over again to play the role of this abusive husband who is got a partner who's cheating on him and he can't deal with it and on and on and on. So So I think the guy with the sauce all over him is Smithy, who is a character within the film that Nikki has now merged with.
Merged with, right. And also, just get a napkin, mate.
Get the napkin.
It's such a funny look. Like, the look on his face while he is covered in sauce and it's literally, like, 90 degrees away from him.
Yeah. And also within that scene, playing into the themes that you've been talking about, that moment where she looks at the two women and says, you know, look at me and say that you see me.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Nah. We don't see you.
They don't. Not at all. On the street, Nikki and Sue are lost within each other, wandering the street with a screwdriver to protect herself. Once again, when she sees that guy and she's, you know, at any point you can be confronted with that aggressive maleness. Her streetwalker friends watch but offer little help. Life is tough enough as it is. Then Doris, who was hypnotized by the Phantom, takes Nikki/Sue's weapon, kills her, leaving her to wander to her death. She finds the street people who talk about catching buses and another street worker who could wear a wig and walk through the rich district without drawing attention. That's interesting. And then the director yells cut and we discover this is a scene from the film being made.
Yep.
So once again, women's pain is brushed over as entertainment and everyone moves on to the next scene. The moment Doris attacks her with her own weapon feeds into my interpretation that when women lash out against women in punitive ways, it can not only be the result of shaped by male-dominated society, but it also hurts both parties.
Yes. Also, throughout that sequence, she's haunting herself.
Yes.
You know, there's a doppelganger of herself across the street that's constantly smiling really in a very sinister way at herself.
Yeah, and barely hiding.
Yeah. Yeah.
Always there.
Yeah.
Always kind of letting them know they're there.
Yeah.
And then the end of this film is... So Nikki has finished her performance in the movie and wanders away dazed by the experience, which I think is once again talking about Lynch's getting lost in yourself.
Yeah.
She wanders-
but also the trouble of walking away from, you know, the production's over.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Hey, you know, they're all like, yay, good job. And she's just like, man, I just, you know.
Yeah, I gave
I just
it
got
all.
Subsumed in this role and I can't just snap out of it.
Yeah.
I'm fucking ruined.
Yeah. By the way, shout out to Jeremy Irons in this.
He's so funny.
He's really funny. Yeah. He's great. He's so great. And also, for you know, for a big time actor to allow himself to be filmed on video where it shows all of the imperfections, like this, that for all of the actors, you know, it's really fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
She wanders into a cinema and watches the film and then the events that are occurring in her life. In the projection room, she finds the apartment building marked Axon N and discovers the Phantom.
Mm-hmm.
She shoots him, and he transforms into a deformed version of Nikki before dying. Is that top three scariest, kind of grossest moments?
That
in the
shot
film?
Of her with the big eyes and the mouth, and it only lasts for about 2 seconds max.
Yeah,
it is. I physically yelled when that happened. It was awful.
Yeah.
It was fucking awful.
That stuck with me.
And then his weird translucent balloon head vomiting blood with black eyes. Like, what is fucking like? Fuck off, man.
You know, anytime since she mentioned it on the Patreon site, anytime we talk about this now, I immediately picture author Sarah Bennett in the UK. You know how she'll write to us and say, thanks for the podcast. That's another movie I won't be watching.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so when we get to these bits, Sarah's the person that I'm picturing all the time now.
You should go there, Sarah. It's a hell of a journey.
No. I've chatted to... So the podcast with Sarah would have gone up by now, but I've just recorded it.
Oh, right.
It's a good thing that she doesn't. She's very happy not seeing those movies.
Okay.
She's a very nice person who does not need this in her life. She shoots him and he transforms into a deformed version of Nikki before dying. Nikki flees into room 47 with the TV rabbits live, but she doesn't notice them. Is that kind of a...
They're gone, right?
Yeah, does it, the door opens and they're kind of looking out and then she goes in and they're not there and it's like she's kind of moved past it.
Yeah,
maybe
yeah,
as a metaphor.
Yeah, sure.
Move past this kind of entertainment. She meets the lost girl, they kiss, everything disappears and the lost girl finds her way out of the hotel and back to her husband and son.
Yeah.
Nikki, back at home, smiles at the Polish woman, finds a one-legged woman that Sue had mentioned, Nico, the streetwalker, and a monkey, which leads to all the women dancing to Nina Simone's cover of Cinnamon.
Yeah. And it ends. And you're sitting there going, what just happened?
Yeah. Yeah, right? So I think this gets back to acting being something that David Lynch is skeptical about, how it can cause damage to the actor's soul. When she finally leaves the role, she can't escape it. And she's back in the cinema. Mm. There she is also trapped in the oldest story of all time, the longest running radio play, Axon N, the aggression towards women. It is only here, after everything she has learned, that she can destroy the fandom. Mm. Nikki has been on a path of enlightenment. Mm. She's able to then pass by the rabbits who represent how mundane traditional stories are and frees the lost girl to make her own decisions. In the end, Nikki has transcended the curse, not just for herself, but all the women around her. And I saw the ending as a triumph.
Mm-hmm.
That this film was distributed independently on video is also a statement. Lynch has created art free of Hollywood, and Laura Dern's Nikki represents what he's moving towards throughout his career, which then paves the way for Twin Peaks: The Return to be his ultimate storytelling statement on TV and storytelling.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Is there anything like I'm reluctant to say, have I missed anything? Because I'm sure I've missed everything. But that was just kind of where I ended
up. No, I love that interpretation. I love that interpretation. Because the one that I've glommed onto is definitely more beat for beat literal.
Right, yeah.
And I feel, though, that this is a movie that I will watch many, many, many more times. Like, it's very... I can't remember the last time I watched a 3-hour, ugly, terrifying movie 2 days apart.
Yeah.
And I really thought the second time was really like, as I was putting the disc on, I was like, oh, for fuck's sake. Like, I didn't want to do it, but I knew it was like, I have to, because I don't know how I'm going to talk about this otherwise.
Yeah.
And I was drawn back in immediately. And it just...
Went quicker.
It went quicker.
Yeah.
And it feels to have infinite riches, this one.
Yeah.
So I actually can't wait to watch it again.
Yeah, it's so bizarre. I had exactly the same thing. Yeah. I've got to rewatch this. And even though I enjoyed that last viewing, it's like, oh, okay. But then it was just like, you're kind of letting the images come to you rather than you go to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
But also, I do think that there is merit to just letting it wash over without even trying to have an interpretation at all.
Yeah.
And just literally treat it like a dream or a nightmare where it is just moments and images and how does it all make you feel. I mean, I think that's why I definitely enjoyed it more the first time, because it washed over me that way where I was, you know, being wrenched from one thing to the other, and 20 minutes in wasn't even trying to figure out what was going on. It was just
Most of the work I did on this came well after the viewing.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
All right, so So I deliberately, as I said, when I'm trying to put things together, I deliberately try to avoid anything so it's fresh.
Yeah.
And then I was like, after I'd finished the script and then I saw this and I thought, oh, it's just funny.
Yeah.
So feel free to jump in at any point.
Yeah.
So this is the synopsis for you, which is from the inland-empire.fandom.com, and you can get into the wiki there and you can read lots of David Lynch stuff, which is really great. But this is their synopsis. In late 19th or early 20th century Poland, a woman known only as the Lost Girl cheated on her controlling, physically abusive husband, credited only as the Phantom. Her lover was also married, and his wife jealously murdered him with a screwdriver, then killed herself. The Phantom either created a curse or, more likely, commandeered an existing curse found in an old gypsy folktale to punish his cheating wife and take his misery out on the world. The Lost Girl was imprisoned in limbo, depicted as a hotel room, forced to watch the suffering her infidelity had caused on TV.
That's great. It's great.
Yeah. Meanwhile, her lover was forced by the Phantom to be continually reincarnated and to relive the story from the Phantom's perspective as the betrayed husband. It seems that the story then played out several times over the following century in various permeations, never quite the same way, but always stemming from infidelity and ending in tragic murder. The other participants were drawn into their cursed roles, often because they were cast in some version of the story. The radio show, Axon N, appears to have put on some version of the story and is associated with the curse, and a feature film based on the old folk tale was abandoned when both leads were murdered. So far, like I feel like my emotional reading of it is still glomming on to the
100%. I mean, as we said earlier in the conversation, it's like this synopsis that you're reading out now is like the skeletal structure of what is actually happening.
Yes.
You know? And I do think, beat for beat, it tracks.
Yeah.
It really tracks.
Yeah. In 2005, a film called On High and Blue Tomorrows is being filmed. It is based on the cursed story. However, no one but the producers is initially aware of this fact. Nikki Grace, a Hollywood actress, plays the Lost Girl role. Her character, Susan Blue, is a married woman who has an affair with Billy Side, a married man. Nikki is married to Piotr Kroll, the latest incarnation of the trapped husband. After years of reliving this scenario, he is cold and controlling. He seemingly realizes that the film role will be deadly for Nikki, but does not attempt to stop her from taking it. As the filming progresses, Nikki toys with the idea of having an affair with her co-star, Devin Burke. And eventually becomes completely trapped in the world of the film due to the curse. I wonder if this is based on, like, you know how... what was it? Was it Mulholland Drive that was inspired by the O.J. Simpson? No, it was Lost Highway. Lost Highway. I wonder, like, this is a wild swing, what I'm about to say, but I wonder if he was inspired by Jennifer Aniston letting Brad Pitt go off to make a movie with Angelina Jolie.
Oh, is that what happened? Is that how they...
Well, they were together and then they went and made Mr. and Mrs. Smith. And who knows, in the real world, maybe they'd kind of split already. Yeah, I'm only going by the gossip rags version of it. But but I could imagine him saying, I just read an interesting article and now I'm going to make a 3-hour movie that's going to blow your minds. In this portion of the film, she now is Susan Blue, a hard woman married to an angry, abusive man, again the trapped husband, now known as Smithy. I don't know why I have to say it that way all the time. By this point, Sue's affair with Billy appears to have ended. Sue, depressed and despondent, befriends the Valley Girls, a group of supernatural beings who may symbolize her shattered consciousness. There you go. Right. At one point, they all speak about one man they have been with, causing Sue to cry. They are likely speaking about Billy. Alternately, they may actually exist, as they act as Sue's guide in catching glimpses of the Lost Girl and the Phantom's backstory and in learning about the curse. In the background of the film are supernatural beings who are trying to stop the Phantom, end the curse, and free the Lost Girl. They are frequently depicted as the rabbits, who manifest as other characters throughout the film, often appearing to be the Phantom's allies, but actually manipulating him towards his demise. The horse was taken to the well is a recurring mantra for these characters.
Yep.
Smithy leaves home and goes to Poland, touring in a circus with the Phantom for a while. I didn't even, like, you know, we didn't even talk about that. And I'm like, fuck, where did that go missing in all my notes? Because I did write notes on that. But anyway.
It is true that the rabbit, because the rabbits also, remember, they live in room 97.
Yes.
Which is the original title of On High and Blue Tomorrows.
Yes. Yeah, right.
So
right.
It's like they're within the curse.
Yeah.
Acting as some kind of, you know, guiding light.
Trying to help out.
Trying to help out. Trying to break this cycle.
Yeah. Smithy leaves home, goes to Poland, tours in a circus with the Phantom for a while, presumably hoping to defeat him. Ultimately, the Phantom disappears and Smithy hunts him with the help of the rabbits and their allies. A Polish man, seen to be a manifestation of Jack Rabbit, gives Smithy a gun which can be used to kill the Phantom. Sue seems to spiral into insanity and depression, ultimately ending up as a prostitute on Hollywood Boulevard along with the Valley Girls. Billy's wife, Doris, jealous and hypnotized by the Phantom, is drawn into the curse and murders Sue on the street. Sue dies, allowing her to be reborn as Nikki back on the film set. That's a beautiful way of looking at that. Mm. That's great.
Mm.
Nikki does not speak a word for the rest of the film, seeming stunned and traumatized. However, she has learned what she needs to do. She moves into another dimension, which seems to be a nexus where various realities meet. Entering Sue's bedroom, Nikki finds the Phantom killing gun that Smithy was given. The Phantom stalks Nikki. However, Nikki kills him, freeing the lost girl and allowing her to reunite in happiness with her lover, both finally freed from the curse.
Yes.
I think I kind of came to this positive breakdown on it after that real deep dive it did in all the Twin Peaks stuff, which made me, because I was like you with Twin Peaks: The Return, I kind of thought that was a really bleak ending, but now I have this different view on it, and I feel like it's once again, it feels like this is a blueprint, really, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it also leans into Lynch's, you know, perspective on life and everything. You know, you see interviews with him where, you know, I think it was Commode's interview with him where he says, you know, you seem like a really sweet, loving guy.
Yeah.
But all your movies are so fucked up. You know, and Lynch's perspective is that you kind of, you know, for his perspective is anyway, that you need to lean into this darkness that exists.
Yeah.
You know, to deny it exists is to kind of, you know, it's that old Grant Morrison thing, you know, that you got to fuck your demons.
Yeah.
You know, you got to make friends with them.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they'll mess you up in ways.
Yeah.
But I think ultimately they're not nihilistic visions. I think that they are visions of profound positivity.
Yeah.
That if you can kind of, you know, move through these spaces with bravery and courage, you know, you come out the other side genuinely free.
Yes.
Genuinely liberated.
Well, that's why all these visions have to be nightmarish, because otherwise it's... So one of the things, and I genuinely am only going to refer to this one movie because I do not want to talk about anything else. But I reckon that's the fatal flaw in Jojo Rabbit, which is that the kid's quite nice from the start. He's just brainwashed by Hitler.
Yeah.
But if he was a shit...
Yeah.
Brainwashed by Hitler, and then he came out the other side. I think then I would have had a...
Yeah.
Like, I know it's a comedy and everything, but I feel like, for me, that's why that movie didn't work, because, you know...
Yeah.
He's... It's just like... Like, it could have just been a story about a kid who liked a football player, and then he found out that football player was a shitheel.
It's true.
You know?
It's true. Yeah, I think if you're going to go... If you're going to explore the realms of darkness... You really need to go there. And, you know, this is storytelling that goes way, way back, you know. I mean, something as old as Dante's Inferno.
Ooh.
You know, it wouldn't be as effective if hell was, you know...
Quite nice.
Just, or, you know, just a little bit scary. It's got to be the most... It's fucking awful.
Yeah.
I mean, it's literally that portion of hell, Inferno... It's whatever it is, 500 pages of the most horrific shit you've ever read in your life.
Yeah.
You know, I always come back to my favorite book, Blood Meridian. You know, it's a vision of utter chaos, carnage, and hell.
Yep.
If you're going to go to those places, it's a disservice to the reality of those realms and those experiences that people have to water them down.
Yeah.
To, you know... And not to delve too deep into our Thor discussion, but that is really at the heart of my issue with that movie. You know, don't evoke stage four cancer if you're not going to go there, man.
Yeah.
Don't go there if you're not going to fucking go there.
Yeah, go there properly. Commit.
Do it.
Yeah, and I think his movies do commit. But I think they commit to such an extent and in a way that, you know, shit's been watered down. Like I was talking to... I was having a conversation with Mum the other day and these are happening more frequently where I have to fucking concede that she was right. But it's so funny. But, you know, we were talking about... Like she was asking me, what's gone wrong with with all of this stuff that you used to love? What's gone wrong with it? And you know, we touched on this before. It was once upon a time... The people who were working in the realm of low art were inspired by high art. Inspired by Virginia Woolf or Shakespeare or, you know, and they were bringing all these great literary influences, or they were listening to Beethoven, or they were listening to...
Absolutely.
You know, and then...
And those things were influenced by the great tales of old, you know.
Right.
It's literally greatness influencing greatness influencing greatness.
Right. And then... But now you've got people who... Like, I think... Like, when I look at... like, I've always liked big ideas and lots of ideas in a comic book. But... And you could say that the current... writers do that, but it's inspired by the Morrisons and the Moores and the Gaimans and the Milligans and the and the Claremonts and people like that. And it's like, oh no, you should be influenced by that, but are you? Like, maybe I'm doing them a disservice, but are you reading the classics? And oh, by the way, in saying that, it's inspiring for me to go and make sure that I do engage with the classics myself, you know. So I'm not, even though I'm being negative towards these things, it's a reminder, well, you know, if you want to have this opinion, you better make sure that you dig into things as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's probably harder than it's ever been because, you know, we lack the eyes and the brains to kind of comprehend a lot of this stuff. I mean, I've told you how it took me nearly a year to read Paradise Lost.
Yeah.
It was impenetrable.
Yeah.
And then, until it wasn't.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it was like, oh, I'm...
Yeah.
I can read this.
Yeah.
You know, but my God, to get into it was hard. Ooh. And it really took a level of commitment that I'm not... And this isn't me going, oh, I'm better than everyone. I'm not.
No, it's the opposite. It's you saying I had to make... I couldn't just pick it up.
Yeah. But I feel like someone whose, you know, brain has been splintered into 1,000 bits by TikTok and Instagram and all the rest.
Yeah.
They're not getting a page into Paradise Lost and going, oh, this is really fucking impenetrable and hard. I'm going to persevere. They're going to go, fuck it. I'll just watch fucking Thor Ragnarok again.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's where the misinterpretation of Lynch comes in, where he does give us these horrific and startling images and thoughts and sounds, but invariably it's all moving towards a sense of peace and a sense of enlightenment, which we've noticed in all of
and that's just about everything. And that's why, you know, I do encourage people to engage with stuff that makes them uncomfortable. It's not because I'm some kind of, you know, sadist going, it feels good to feel shit.
Yeah.
The project isn't to feel like shit. The project is to come out the other side. You know, I don't read Blood Meridian once a year because I love reading about people getting scalped and murdered.
Yeah.
That's not what it's about.
Yeah.
It's about getting to the other side of it.
Yeah.
And having a sense of gratitude to live in a time when that's not happening, or to revel in the poetry of incredible writing that can depict these things and yet still leave you with a feeling that you've, you know, read true literature. Like, there's so much more to it than, you know, I think that's what people miss when they kind of just lump stuff into it made me feel good or it made me feel bad.
Yes.
It's got to be more than that. And also, is feeling good all the time necessarily good for you?
Yeah.
I don't think it's psychologically a great place to be, to always kind of have this kind of this kind of sated, you know, that's the great criticism of in Brave New World, Soma.
Yeah.
Is it is that life? To just to feel pleasant all the time? Because if you feel pleasant all the time, then it's just this grey, miasmic kind of nothing. You're just kind of sedated.
You know, that's where the tragedy of art becoming entertainment lies, you know. And, you know, people aren't going to... like, the amount of people that look at me as if I'm insane when I said, oh, I had a really stressful week at The Chase. So, to relax, I went and saw Drive My Car, a three-hour Japanese film about grief.
That makes sense to me.
It was great. And I felt so relieved at the end of it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. But, this links to criticisms I've made of the phones and everything. I think that's a huge part of it as well, you know, this inability to sit with something.
Yeah.
You know, you either have to react to it, take a photo of it, whatever it is, it is the immediate reaction is to somehow disengage yourself from it rather than get totally lost in it.
Yeah.
And I think the art, I really resist calling it art, but whatever, the content that's being made these days, I think is designed to feed that need for instantaneous reaction now. And so it's not about sitting with something and fully immersing in it and thinking about it. It's about logging on to Twitter or whatever the second it finishes and, you know, or onto YouTube and watching the breakdown video and the 400 Easter eggs you missed and everything. It's not actually about the art anymore. It's about everything around the art.
Yeah.
You know, I have that compulsion as well. I'm not saying I'm immune from it.
No, no,
you know,
no.
When Inland Empire ended, my first reaction
was
to go on to... I didn't.
No.
But I
recognize that.
You know what I mean? It was well, what did it mean? Yeah. It's like, fucking... You can do that tomorrow.
I put on an album.
Yeah. In the end, I just sat there in the darkness going, like, Jesus Christ. But, you know, like, I get it. But I fear that we are definitely losing that as a culture.
Yeah.
The ability to sit with something... or the ability to just experience a spectrum of emotion.
Yeah.
You know, my favorite movie of the last probably 5 years was Come and See.
Yeah.
The most harrowing thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
And conversely, one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah. Felt that way a little bit about Stalker too.
Stalker was outstanding.
Yeah. Get that on YouTube, people. That's a hell of a film. I have some squid bits, and then Ben and I are going to, as a little treat for you, we're going to give you our rankings of David Lynch films. So, first up, squid bits. David Lynch filmed the movie on a handheld Sony DSR-PD-150. It would have cost around $4,000 back in 2001. After the film was shot, he declared he would no longer shoot on celluloid because this new medium allowed him more room to dream. With a smaller crew, less setup time, and most importantly, no accountability to producers. Do you want to say this, Ben? This is a quote from him. Film is a dinosaur in a tar pit.
Film is a dinosaur in a tar pit.
Perfect. Inland Empire was written a scene at a time and shot piecemeal over the course of 3 years. It is incorrect that there wasn't a script. Lynch told a reporter this year in 2022 that there was an actual script and implied that some of it consisted of drawings. So it sounds like like the Mad Max Fury Road.
Great.
There's been a remastered version of this movie doing the rounds in North America and released on the Criterion Collection this year.
I would watch it.
I'd
be fascinated to watch it.
Oh, I'd love to see it in the cinema. I missed it at the cinema.
Was it showing in the cinema in Australia?
I don't know. I
would love to see it.
I remember, I reckon if it did, it was on for 3 hours and then never shown again. Yeah. So the only reason I saw it was because I got it from overseas as well.
Right.
On December 13, 2006, Lynch sat at the intersection of Hollywood Boulevard and L.A. Bray Avenue, L.A. with a live cow, the cow's handler, and a big picture of Laura Dern with her name and the words, "For your consideration," emblazoned on it to promote Laura Dern, for every award because I believe she gave the best performance of the year and one that will live on in time.
She did.
You know what I love about that? The cow's handler. The cow's handler's there as well.
Have you seen the clip of that of someone driving along? They're like, is that David Lynch sitting with a cow?
I did see that. Yeah, so good. So good.
Cows make cheese.
He's so funny. He's just so funny. When asked in an Entertainment Weekly interview what the lumberjack is doing in the final scene, Lynch replied, "Cutting wood." There's more to this response, but just those two words was like, "No, that's the perfect way to finish this season of Deep Dive Directors." In Greek, axon means axle, an axis of a solid like cone or cylinder, the axis of the celestial sphere or a course or path of action. For fans of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Terry Crews is one of the street people when Nicky dies. He's the guy in the background. And Terry Crews is funny. So to see him... anyway, let me put it this way. His character on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, who's also Terry would be very bothered by the scene. It would put him off his yoga. That's a very specific Brooklyn Nine-Nine joke, but they should appreciate it. On the DVD, there is a collection of deleted scenes called More Things That Happen, which runs for another 75 minutes. Some scenes are short and inconsequential, while others are quite long and flesh out the themes. Did you check it out?
I haven't got the... it's so annoying. I've got the Blu-ray, and they don't have those scenes on the fucking Blu-ray.
That's weird.
Why I bought the Blu-ray for a low-res movie, I don't know, but there we have it.
Yeah, that's funny.
Anyway.
Lynch actually ran into Dern who he hadn't seen in a long time, and they agreed they should work on something. At the time, Lynch was working on his website, producing the series Rabbits, themes from The Darkened Room, and the eventually unrealized Axon N, which all ended up playing a part in this movie. Lynch wrote a 14-page dialogue that Dern shot for a 70-minute scene. He didn't release it because he considered it too good and held a secret for more. Dern was paid the standard internet rate of $100.
Legend.
So funny. Initially, Lynch paid the budget out of his pocket, and then Studio Canal became involved and contributed $4 million. All right. So just to finish off, I thought, do you want to rank your... Lynch list.
Sure.
Do you want to go from... Why don't...
10 to 1.
Yeah, go from 10 to 1, and why don't you tell me yours, and I'll let you know.
Now, with all of this, it's probably only the first two that are, like, solidly locked in.
Yeah.
Number 1 and number 2.
Sorry, is this from the bottom?
No, I'm just prefacing before I say the list.
Yeah.
That's not true. The last two and the first two.
Okay.
Everything in between could change in a heartbeat.
Okay.
This is just how I feel right now.
Okay. So what do you have at number 10?
I love all of these movies apart from two.
Okay. So number
10. So number 10, Dune.
Yep. So we agree on Dune.
Dune, because it's not a fully realized vision of Lynch. It's compromised. Yeah. And the rest.
Yeah. No, that's the problem. Like, you know, I still had a good time watching it, but like...
Yeah. It's not.
When will I be rewatching this film?
No.
No.
Exactly. Number 9, Wild at Heart.
Oh, interesting.
I don't love Wild at Heart.
Right.
I love the idea of it, and I love moments.
Yep.
But fully as a movie, it's definitely right down the bottom for me.
Yeah.
You're going to hate me. Number 8, Lost Highway.
Yep. No. Like, there's no right or wrong.
No. Again, with Lost Highway, I love pieces of it.
Yeah.
It doesn't, for me, doesn't work as a coherent whole thing. It's not something I buzz and enjoy watching. And I've done it 3 or 4 times now.
Yeah.
And that's always the feeling I have at the end of it. Having said that, that's how I was with Blue Velvet for many years. And then that suddenly flipped. So at any moment, that could change.
Yeah.
Number 7, The Straight Story.
Yep.
It's only this low down because I've only seen it once and I don't know it well, but I cannot wait to revisit. Number 6, Blue Velvet. Number 5, The Elephant Man.
Yep.
Number 4, Inland Empire.
Yep.
Number 3, Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. Do you want to guess what my number 2 and 1 are? No. Well, you know what they are, but which is the order?
No.
Number 2, Eraserhead. Number 1, Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, right. Right. Interesting.
And Mulholland Drive and Eraserhead, as I say, that list could change, but it's always Mulholland Drive and Eraserhead for me. I think those two are absolute unimpeachable masterpieces.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. So I go It's so funny. Like, this is, I reckon, in all honesty, only Lost Highway at number one is locked in for me.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because, like, with even with like Nolan and Coppola, again, I like all of those movies, but I would find it a lot easier to whatever ranking means, but to rank them. The Lynch ones, it's really like...
It kind of depends on your mood.
Depends on your mood.
Yeah.
And I think that they're all, apart from those bottom couple, I think they're all just beyond brilliant. And this rewatch has... I've always really liked him. After this, I love him.
Yeah.
And I wasn't going to rewatch Twin Peaks. And it was like, literally, I just put it on because it was like, I'm not ready to leave this world yet.
Yeah. So I'll go, since we've gone through your list, I'll just... bang through mine from one, from 10 to 1. Yeah. So 10 was Dune.
Yeah.
9 was Eraserhead.
Whoa.
Yeah. Which I really enjoyed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Then it was The Straight Story.
Uh-huh.
Then The Elephant Man.
Yep.
Then Wild at Heart.
Right.
Then Wild at Heart, it's an interesting film. I loved that as a kid. Like, when I saw it at the cinema. Wow. But I think it was such a cinematic experience that I still have quite a lot of affection for it. But it's... there is something... There's just other things I like better. Blue Velvet.
Which what are you up to? 5?
I am up to... I'm up to 6.
Okay, yeah.
So Blue Velvet was 6.
Mm-hmm.
Twin Peaks, a European movie.
Oh, fuck. I forgot
to... to put the European movie. Matter. It doesn't matter. Like, I still... Like, it still gives me that same joy that I had when I first saw it with my friend Matthew Paxton.
Yeah.
Then at number 4, Inland Empire.
Yeah.
Number 3, Mulholland Drive. Number 2, Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, which took a... That is possibly... Has shot up from second to last.
Oh, yeah.
And then Lost Highway.
Isn't it funny, the reappraisal of Fire Walk With Me?
Yes.
And that's across the board.
Yes.
Again, I saw an interview with Kermode.
Yep.
Where he was talking about that. He was one of the early proponents of that film.
Right.
Like, on day one, was like, this is a masterpiece.
Yep.
But, you know, he said he felt very vindicated that that's now suddenly been recognised for what it is.
Yeah, no, I get it.
And as we said at the time, I think it can be enjoyed without knowing anything about Twin Peaks lore. I think you can watch it just as a movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if anything, like, I you know, because we were watching them as movies, I feel like... Because I rewatched it just before Twin Peaks: The Return, and because I hadn't rewatched Twin Peaks, but I knew that this, there was stuff that saying that the movie was going to be important, unencumbered by the history of Twin Peaks, is also important to it, and also, you know, like, that second season loses its focus. Right. So yeah, and someone comes up to you and says, "I'm thinking of watching a David Lynch film." What do you say, which one do you suggest?
And they've never seen one before.
And they've never seen one. And which one do you tell them, do not start with this?
Don't start with Inland Empire.
Yeah.
Like, definitely not.
Yeah.
Probably Mulholland Drive.
Interesting, yeah.
Probably Mulholland Drive. This is if you want the full-blown experience of his, you know, all of his running themes... All of his tropes, you know, because you could... There's probably easier entry points.
Yeah.
The Straight Story, Wild at Heart. But I don't think that you're getting the full spectrum of Lynch.
Yeah.
Twin Peaks, I would say, might be a bit too fucking much.
Yeah.
To begin with. I think Mulholland Drive is... Yeah, I think it's the perfect entry point.
That's... I'd probably say Eraserhead is, for me, I'd say. Maybe don't start with Eraserhead. And then I'd probably, depending on the person, I might suggest Blue Velvet.
Yeah.
You know, because it just kind of is,
yeah.
You know, if you watch Blue Velvet and you can't cope with Dennis Hopper, check out. You're going to be okay.
I'm wondering if I saw Blue Velvet before Mulholland Drive.
Right.
I can't remember. But yeah, like, I think Mulholland Drive was the first... It's definitely the first Lynch that I remember having, like, a major impact.
Yeah.
And that was, I was, you know, 18 or 19 years old.
Yeah.
so I didn't even have the language for it. But I remember just being absolutely floored by it. And to this day, you know, we watched it, what, 3-4 weeks ago?
Yeah.
And it was better than ever.
Mate, it was so good. It was a good suggestion. And then we might as well, should we tell them what we're going to do for, because we're going to give deep dive directors a rest. And we're going to do, so there's been this idea that we've been playing around with. Yeah, we'll tell them because then they can start watching. So we were thinking of top five, so we could, which could then let us focus on actors, actresses, directors, mm-hmm. etc. Mm-hmm. So we're going to do our first top five. Mm. And we have a guest who's also going to be helping us out with the finale.
Oh,
I've
really?
Already locked them in.
Very good. And I know the guest.
Yeah, yes. You know the guest. And we are going to watch all of the movies that John Cazale made. And he only made five films, and all five of them were nominated for Best Picture or won Best Picture. Mm-hmm. And those five films are The Godfather, The Godfather Part 2, The Conversation, Dog Day Afternoon, and The Deer Hunter. And even though those movies have been talked about a lot, we are going to view them through not only the performance of Cazale, mm-hmm. but I'm going to give you a little backstory on where Cazale was at throughout those. So it'll be a slightly different flavor to deep dive directors. Yeah. But if you want to, you know, the next season will start like at the end of August, beginning of September. So mm-hmm. if you want to get ahead of the curve and start watching those films, they are the films to do so.
Oh, and all great, like, you know, all just solid films. You know, if you're someone who is wanting to maybe broaden your horizons, if you're not a big film watcher, they're all really easy films to watch, but also just really a lot of meat on the bone.
Well, some of the greatest films ever
made. Some of the greatest films ever made.
Yeah.
I mean, if you got to be an actor who dies young is only in five films, my God.
Like, it's what a crazy run. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of season five of Big Squid. Thank you to Ben, not just for his time on this particular podcast, but for his great company across the whole season. Ben will be back for season six. So don't worry, he's not one of the changes. But we are changing up things a little bit. We're not going to do a new deep dive director series. To be honest, Ben and I just couldn't agree on who we wanted to dig into. And rather than compromise, we decided, maybe we'll give that a bit of a rest. But in doing so, I came up with a new idea, and it's got a very simple title. We're introducing a new series called Top 5. And what we're going to do is we're going to look at our favorite performances by certain actors and actresses in particular films. And the first season of Top 5 is focusing on John Cazale. Now, you might not be 100% familiar with that name, but you would definitely recognize him because John died at a much, much too young age, and he only made five films. But those five films were The Godfather, The Conversation, The Godfather 2, Dog Day Afternoon, and The Deer Hunter. They are his only five films. Isn't that insane? And all five, at the very least, were nominated for Best Picture, and some even won. So we're going to be viewing those brilliant, brilliant movies, but through the prism of Cazale, and I'll be giving you a little bit of a history lesson on the man himself. So it'll be a little bit like Deep Dive Directors, but a slightly different flavour. And I think it's a nice little change up. But we'll come back with Deep Dive Directors soon. But in the meantime, you can gear up for Top 5 with John Cazale. I wanted to call it Up There Cazale, but I don't know how many of you are old school AFL fans and you might have been confused by that. If that makes two people laugh, I'm happy to drop it right here. But anyway, if you want to get ahead of the Top 5 series that will be coming out next season, you can start rewatching all five of those films before the season starts, or you can wait to hear what we have to say before maybe returning to those films or watching them for the first time. I don't think there's any right or wrong way to do it. Maybe if you've seen those films before, as I said, we're going to be discussing them literally through the prism of that actor. So we will hopefully be finding different angles for you that aren't the usual angles on, you know, especially like movies like The Godfather and The Godfather 2 that have been discussed to such lengths. You know, it's a new way to discuss those films and hopefully just shine a light on a talent that was taken way too soon. What a bummer. Just the stuff that he would be creating now and all the movies that we missed out on. And, you know, and that's just from a selfish point of view, the life that he would have lived as well. Such a beautiful actor. Anyway, I'm looking forward to bringing that to you in season 6. And we will be bringing back some of your favorite segments. So don't worry, Space Podyssey, Pass the Amel, Beautiful Tales for the Disenchanted. They're the three that you wrote to me the most about, including Deep Dive Directors. So they'll be coming back. And, you know, we'll still be looking at a few other little segments as well. A lot of love for Sarah Bennett and romance. Who would have thought all you people out there were such softies at heart? So we've got an idea for something towards the end of the year as well. So hopefully we can make that work for you. A big thank you to our Patreon subscriber of the episode, Glenn. I hope you enjoyed not just this season, but your podcast as well. Please say hello to Suze for me and give Oscar a hug. Remember, if you'd like to sign up to our growing Big Squid community and have access to bonus material, remember there's a Patreon-only episode coming out later this week with my thoughts on Oppenheimer and Moon Age Daydream. Head over to patreon.com/JustinHamilton_BigSquid. Adelaide, remember to use your code to get money off your tickets for our live Big Squid recording in Adelaide on the 16th of September. Head over to adelaidecomedy.com, use the discount code BIGSQUID, and you will be able to join me with my guests Rove, Will Anderson, Tom Gleason, Adam Richard, Georgia Mooney, Limo, Mickey D, and making his Adelaide debut, Ben Elwood. Melbourne and Sydney, don't forget to use your discount code for my live show, Little Victories, and you will score cheaper tickets to see me at the Sydney Comedy Store on the 28th of October and Comedy Republic on the 26th of November. The code is PODCAST. Thank you for everything, everyone. I really appreciate it. I appreciate your time. I appreciate you being a fantastic community. I love making this podcast, and it's just a real treat to have such a smart audience. And it's not just that you're smart, but you're inquisitive, you're creative, you're funny, and you're loyal. And I do not take any of that for granted. And you know what? It gives me confidence as well to continue to push this podcast in new and exciting places. You know, you've known me for a while now. You know my work. You know that if things are stagnant, that's when I start to really struggle. Even if it's successful, if it's stagnant and not feeling like it's moving forward or pushing boundaries or, you know, just trying something that is a little bit different, you know, that's when I start to kind of lose focus and lose impetus. So thank you for keeping me inspired. And I can't talk about some of the other things that I'm working on at the moment, but there are plans, especially with Beautiful Tales for the Disenchanted. There's something that I'm working towards that if I can... It probably needs another season of you getting used to the format and getting used to what we're doing there. But once that's up and running, that's got a big plan that I'm really keen to get rolling. But, you know, I want to do it properly, so baby steps, as it were. Who knows what the new season of Big Squid will hold? And I thought, well, just for our fun, I'm going to make a prediction. So let's see if this holds up. We won't be able to know if this prediction is correct until towards the end of the year, but I'm going to make this prediction for you and we can see how we feel towards the end of November. And my prediction is, I think Wakanda Forever is going to be the best Marvel movie since the double punch of Avengers Infinity War and Endgame. It's going to blow everything out of the water that we've seen recently. It's going to blow the series out of the water. And we're going to look at that and we're going to go, that is a good film, a properly good film. I have a lot of faith in Ryan Coogler, and the trailer made me quite emotional. And I was watching it with, as you can guess, the slight indifference that I have felt towards Marvel over the course of the 17 movies and TV series they have released in the last 18 months. That's too much! But that trailer looked tasty. So fingers crossed I'm right. That would be good if I'm right. It would be a bummer if I'm wrong. It's not a prediction to be right. It's a prediction to be hopefully right. Let's finish this season with a quote from Ingmar Bergman. Film is dream, film is music. No art passes our conscience in the way film does and goes directly to our feelings, deep down into the dark rooms of our souls. Take care out there. Until then.